Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp. I'm sitting in today for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Every time you go online, it's likely that you are sharing information. Whether you are writing emails or searching for a recipe or just maybe reading updates from friends on social media, data about you and what you're looking at is getting collected and stored away by companies that offer data services. Of course, ever since last week's Facebook appearance before Congress, Mark Zuckerberg's testimony has raised a lot of questions, and suddenly data privacy is a topic of conversation. The whole practice of collecting user information in exchange for a free service has become the discussion, and the new catchphrase is, of course, if you are not a paying customer, then you must be the product. But how did the collection and storage of information become so widespread, and what are the potential impacts? In the whole conversation about social media giants and their data collection habits, other information-grabbing companies may have been forgotten. For example, remember when Equifax was facing lawsuits and fines after that credit reporting agency had a breach? It exposed over 100 million people's highly sensitive information. A lot of us have forgotten about that very serious breach. And, of course, today is tax day, and millions of us may be using the online tax preparation services. They are often billed as being free services to give you help filing your taxes. Well, have you really looked at the fine print? What information are you signing away in exchange for using those free tax prep services? In effect, have we allowed just a few companies to monopolize information about us? What consequences will that have for our society and for the preservation of our privacy? We're going to talk about that today on Your Call. To tell us more about who's collecting information about us and what impact that may be having, we're speaking today with Kevin Carty. Kevin is a reporter and researcher with the Open Markets Institute. He covers issues of technology and platforms and other competitive and market consolidation issues. Open Markets is a research and advocacy group, and they're fighting concentrations of private power and corporate monopolies. It's quite a mandate, and we're happy to have you here. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I got choked up just thinking about it. Look, companies are collecting information about users to serve them. It seems fairly innocuous. What's wrong with that?
Well, traditionally we've thought of data collection as a problem related to privacy. And that's true. It is a problem as it, you know, poses questions about the amount of data collected on us and what our control over that data really is. But it also, data collection also serves as a way for big companies to increase their advantage over smaller companies. That when you are a company like, say, Facebook, which has over 70% of the social media market in the U.S. and as much power globally as well, that means that there's really nobody else collecting the same type and quality of data that Facebook is collecting. And that gives Facebook a massive advantage over anybody else who wants to compete, who would want to compete in that space, whether it's another social media company or another company that wants to compete against Facebook for selling ads. So we should absolutely be caring about data collection as a potential violation of our own personal privacy, but we should also look at it as an issue of corporate power. These collection practices can really increase and further enable the worst anti-competitive tactics of some of the biggest corporations in America and in the world today.
Well, Ross Perot started this whole thing, and we didn't see anything wrong with the idea back then. What's the difference?
Yeah, it's true. You know, data collection is not exactly a new problem. You talked about Equifax, and Equifax is actually a very old company. It's a new name. Only, you know, in the last couple of decades did they rename themselves to Equifax. But they were actually originally founded in 1899 to do credit reporting and gather information about consumers for things like banks and stuff like that. So it isn't an old problem. What I would say makes it unique today is that now a lot of this data collection is packaged and connected with other types of important services that A, we as consumers don't expect that to be connected to, and which B, the owners of those services can use to increase their power. So, yeah, companies have always been collecting our data, but when the company which became Equifax, which used to be called the Retail Credit Company, founded in 1899, when they first started, we had things like the telegraph and the telephone and these communication services. But nobody was, you know, tracking our phone calls or our telegraphs for information about us, whether to sell to some other company or to serve ads. But today, that is basically the case. Companies read our email. Companies read the messages we send to each other on social media. They do all sorts of things. And so it's really the coupling of data collection and these other essential services that I think is something new to us in the United States and, you know, for everyone in our, you know, increasingly tech-dominated world.
Well, are you kind of facing an uphill battle as you and your company attempt to, you know, Open Markets Institute is trying to sound an alarm here, but I think Americans and people in general love these platforms. Latest polls found that 86% of Americans have a favorable view of Google, 80% have a favorable impression of Amazon. So how do you sound the alarm about something that people seem to love so much?
Well, I think there's a couple ways to think about it. The first is that we should clearly still be able to have the technologies and services that these companies provide. You're right. Google and Facebook and Amazon are popular for a reason. I mean, people do like their services, and we should continue to live in a world in which services like that are still provided. But I do think that the tide is slowly turning against these big tech companies. You could see in the Zuckerberg hearings last week that lawmakers from both parties were asking very tough questions of Mr. Zuckerberg. And lawmakers from both parties were also talking about the need for regulation. You know, it wasn't exactly what everyone expected, that you would hear Republicans as well as Democrats saying, you know, it sounds like we have a need for more regulation of big tech companies like Facebook. But that's exactly what happened. So, yes, you're right that these companies are, you know, popular. But that is beginning to change. And I think that the Zuckerberg hearings were just one example of that changing political environment.
Well, let's talk a bit about the data collector that's on everybody's mind. Mark Zuckerberg testified before Congress, and it became clear that Facebook sold millions of users to a company that was seeking global political influence. It's called Cambridge Analytica. But it was really striking to me, for folks who haven't really kept up with this, that the way that this happened was through one of those quiz apps. You know, are you a geography whiz? So through a quiz app, the information from anybody that took the quiz got siphoned off, and not just the profile of the person taking that innocuous-looking little quiz, but it also siphoned their friends' information. And the maker of that quiz app then sold the information to Cambridge Analytica. So just walk us through how people who are just using the internet as a potentially innocuous tool are getting pulled into this data mining.
Well, you know, I'll try to make this simple. What Facebook does is that Facebook is commonly understood as a social media company. And that's true. It is a social media company. But the people that Facebook actually gets money from are advertisers. Facebook creates and sells ads to businesses, whether that be a bar down the street that's looking to attract new customers, or that be a huge multi-billion-dollar international corporation. Lots of people buy ads on Facebook, and Facebook profits from that. That is the main source of Facebook's money. Something like 98% of all of Facebook's revenue came from advertising last year. And so the way that Facebook creates those ads is that it collects data on all of its users. That includes everything that, you know, you know that you give Facebook. Like, for instance, if you post on the Facebook newsfeed, chances are you might know as a user that Facebook will gather some information about that post that you made. But you might be less aware of the fact that when you know, leave Facebook and go on another website, if there is a Facebook like button at the bottom of that website, then Facebook knows what you're doing on that website as well. The point is that Facebook is collecting an enormous amount of data on everybody on its service, as well as other people not on its service or not using its service at the moment. And it uses that data to create highly targeted ads that are very, very profitable for Facebook. And the reason that this matters in respect to Cambridge Analytica is that fundamentally, because Facebook's business model is about collecting all this data and serving it to advertisers, it means that anybody who wants to serve an ad on Facebook, or in the case of Cambridge Analytica, if you are, say, a game developer and you want to make a game to work on Facebook, anybody who's an advertiser or, in that case, an app developer can ultimately have access to the data on Facebook. Because Facebook is collecting so much of this data and then they're trying to make money by creating ads with it, that means that anybody who's going to buy an ad or anybody who wants to use the Facebook platform to, say, you know, create this quiz, like you said in the Cambridge Analytica example, they are also going to have access to this data. I hope that, you know, kind of answers the question.
I think for most of us, Kevin, it's sort of like when you turn on the ignition to your car. I don't need to know how a combustion engine works. I just need I need the tool. I need the car to work. But a car can be a very dangerous thing, and I'm thinking that this is the same thing. For those of us who just kind of troll the internet and use it as a tool, how dangerous is it that most people probably only understood about 10, 20, maybe 30% of what you just explained and are thereby really vulnerable to the kind of data mining that has become the business model, not just for Facebook, but for others?
Well, unfortunately, I think we're all subject to this data mining, whether or not we understand the system that it's actually working under. I think we all have our data collected. And the truth is that when with so many big companies doing these things, you know, collecting information about us and our buying habits and our medical history and our friends and what we talk about and what we search about and all of these things, that is such the norm, has become so powerful and dominant in our tech economy that there really are not a whole lot of options to kind of, you know, get away from it. There are services you can use, like DuckDuckGo is this kind of new web browser that doesn't track you in the same way that Google does. But by and large, this is a question that needs to be resolved politically. Individual consumers don't really have a lot of options to, say, protect their own data. At the end of the day, we have to reform the entire tech economy to address this issue. Individual people, you know, while of course we can do things to minimize our risk and do things like download apps which create virtual private networks. You can Google that if you're interested in something that'll make you more safer online. Or you can look at the data collection practices of your email provider and make sure that they're not reading your email. You can do things like that, and that's all well and good. But it doesn't answer the fundamental problem that the entire tech economy, huge portions of it, are organized around this wholesale data collection.
If you're just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. And today we're talking about how corporations are acquiring and using data about each and every one of us. We'd love to hear from you. Which companies do you think have your data? And what do you want to know about how they are using it? Join the conversation. The number is 866-798-8255. You can send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. We're talking to Kevin Carty. He's a reporter and researcher at the Open Markets Institute. And Kevin, I'm wondering why the 2011 consent decree is not constraining Facebook and the other companies. But, you know, the consent decree specifically from 2011 meant that Facebook was agreeing to get the consent from their users before sharing their data with third parties. And that's one thing about the testimony that I thought they didn't really nail him very well on in terms of people's ability to opt out. So talk about whether the consent decree is working or if it's just being ignored.
It does look like that it has been ignored. Now, this is ultimately for the Federal Trade Commission to determine, and there will be new Federal Trade Commission members, you know, sometime within the next year. Donald Trump is set to appoint 5 new members. We're on the way to that. So that's for them to determine. But it does seem, from my point of view and from the point of view of a lot of experts, we're not alone in thinking this, that Facebook did violate the 2011 consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission, that users did not we're not given really the opportunity to fully consent to the extent to which their data was being collected and, you know, in this case, shared with this group, Cambridge Analytica. And it was remarkable to me during the hearings. I think you're right that that the lawmakers could have done a better job of really hammering this exact issue. But nonetheless, I was still pleased to see that several of them did bring up the FTC 2011 consent decree. I know, it's hard to think of exactly who said what off mm-hmm. the top of my head, but I know Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut said that he thought that the consent decree had been violated, and he was not the only one. So to your original question, I think that the consent decree did not achieve its goals of making sure that Facebook users would have to consent to all of the use of their data. It seems that Facebook violated that, and that calls for more enforcement from the federal government, and in this case, from the Federal Trade Commission.
Are you surprised, Kevin, that people aren't more up in arms? I know that there are a lot of organizations and institutes and they're in the business of letting people know about the issue of data mining. But I'm just really surprised. But I was interested in some of the comparisons that have been made to monopolists of the past, the old-fashioned robber barons from the Standard Oil days that used to rule the American economy a century ago. But I think that maybe back then, people who were concerned were able to actually see the results. They could see the smoke-belching refineries, and they saw all of the Standard Oil presences. But somehow Google, Apple, Amazon are a little less obvious, if not entirely secret. So is that part of why maybe there's not more of a groundswell about this whole data mining issue?
I think that is part of it. That it is difficult to see the power that these companies exert over our lives. That when you go on Google or Facebook, it's difficult to really understand the power that company is exercising. But I do think that is beginning to change. And I think the way that we can see this is that these scandals that keep coming up around these tech companies, whether it's around there have been scandals about bad content for kids on YouTube and the rise of terrorist propaganda on YouTube, for instance. And there's been these recent scandals about Facebook. And there was the it's a little bit different, but the hack of Equifax that you mentioned earlier. All of these scandals kind of have something in common, which is that they seem more real than the sort of standard privacy violating stuff that I think a lot of people have gotten used to. These scandals are not about, oh, well, somebody got my data, but they're, in the case of Cambridge Analytica, they're also tied up in questions of the 2016 election and whether you think that this ultimately did influence the election or that the Cambridge Analytica's activities did influence how the election went or not. I think a lot of people agree that they're concerned about the role that Facebook plays in politics generally. And so that's an example of a scandal which I think is kind of breaking out of people's usual concern about privacy and how that's kind of easy to ignore and thus really affecting their day-to-day lives. Another example of this that I really think shows how people are starting to wake up to the power of the new tech giants is there's been a lot of mobilization against Amazon trying to set up its second headquarters. As you know, a lot of people know, mm-hmm. Amazon is trying to build this second facility and is trying to get a whole bunch of cities and states to compete against each other to give the sweetest deal to the company to set up there. And there's been a lot of mobilization about that. Hasn't been too much in the national press, but there's activist groups all over the country that are trying to fight that, or at least trying to make it so that the deals that these cities and states are giving to Amazon are transparent and fair.
And yet cities are falling all over each other to get it. So there it is.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Kevin McCarty is a reporter and researcher at the Open Markets Institute, and we welcome your questions for him at 866-798-8255. Let's go to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil.
This is a really topical discussion, because yesterday on KLW I heard the open source program where Chris Lydon devoted the show to what is now, I guess it's being called, surveillance capitalism. And Robert, doing a little Googling after the show, I guess Robert McChesney, the journalism professor at U of I, University of Illinois, coined the term in 2014 to refer to Facebook and Google, et cetera. And on open source, they had this Harvard Business School professor who's worked in IT-related things for 30 years, named Shoshana Zuboff. Apparently, she has a new book coming out on the topic of surveillance capitalism. And one of the things she pointed out, by the way, for, you know, all of our justifiable unhappiness with what Cambridge Analytica did in 2016, she pointed out that Eric Schmidt, who was at the time the CEO of Google, he and a bunch of Google scientists in 2008 and then again in 2012 worked with the Obama campaign doing almost the exact same thing. And anyway, but this concept of surveillance capitalism, as I said, if people are interested in this, I'd really recommend they go and listen to the open source show that you guys broadcast yesterday for some more detail. And it truly is it's Big Brother with a commercial twist.
Thanks a lot, Phil. I must say the combination of those two words together, surveillance and capitalism, is pretty spooky. Kevin?
Yeah, I'm happy that Phil brought up the fact that, Cambridge Analytica was not the first group to take advantage of this data collection. It's true, the Obama campaign did really similar stuff during the lead up to the 2012 election. And I think that in the same way that we've, you know, many of us have harshly criticized Facebook's response to Cambridge Analytica and, you know, the role it played in the 2016 election, I think people should also look back to 2011 and 2012 and say, well, what else was Facebook allowing political operatives to collect and get away with? Because I think that it really goes beyond this one scandal. Phil's right to kind of draw this broader connection.
866-798-8255 is the number. What are your questions about how our data is being mined? Kevin, I'm also struck by the fact that tech companies can dominate entire sectors without actually producing anything. Apple doesn't produce music, but it controls a huge amount of the music industry. Facebook doesn't produce news, but news organizations are highly dependent on them as a social platform. And the instances go on. Amazon is now in the grocery business after buying Whole Foods. So, and they're now in the healthcare business. So I think that kind of plays into the whole description of a change in capitalism in which actually no product is being sold and yet billions of dollars are being made. This is a new paradigm, yes?
Yes, to a certain extent, yeah, it really is. There are, you know, similarities to things that we've seen before, but a lot of this really is new. And the way that I think to tie together all of the examples that you just brought up is that Facebook, Amazon, Uber, Airbnb, Grubhub, all of these different companies operate very similar business models. They all operate platforms, which is a word you hear a lot in Silicon Valley tech speak, which is basically a description of a private marketplace. So let's take Uber, for instance. Uber has a platform for, you know, getting you a cab, essentially. You know, it's not called a cab, it's an Uber, but that's what it is. They own this platform that you, the user, open up on your phone and you look for a ride and then you find a ride and then it comes and it goes. But Uber is not the one who's actually driving you. Of course, they don't employ the actual drivers. They've gone to court to make sure that those drivers remain independent contractors, so Uber doesn't have to provide them with benefits or rights. Uber doesn't own the car. Uber doesn't provide the insurance. It doesn't do any of the actual stuff that you're getting. It's not driving you around or anything like that. That's exactly what you described. Uber is, you know, has constructed this platform that is really powerful in the space, but they're not actually producing anything. And that is what is common about these different companies that I listed. They all have this similar model where they all create a platform where they serve as some, they create a platform, a private marketplace that allows them to be a middleman over the sector so that the businesses who are operating on that platform, in Uber's case, it's the drivers who are selling their services to drive you, operate on this platform, and users come to that platform to pick drivers. But the problem with this business model is that separates the businesses themselves who are actually providing stuff, right? It separates the drivers from the riders, because Uber is stepping between those two. And it gives Uber a huge amount of power over both sides of the equation.
Kevin, right. I'm going to interrupt you there because we're going to talk about the extent to which this business paradigm, all the way down the line, whether it's music listeners and music providers, where these apps literally step in between the consumer and the creator. We're going to take a break. Kevin McCarty, researcher at Open Markets Institute, is our guest. We'll be back right after a short break.
This is Your Call on KALW. There are many ways you can take part in today's conversation. On the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from Joshua Johnson, WABU. The station is. It's from Washington, indeed. WAMU in Washington. And it's the problem of prisons as the topic. Stay tuned for that show. Much more articulate host, I'm sure.
Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call. We're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Listen to past shows there. And if you have a show idea for us, give us a call at yourcall@kalw.org. Tomorrow, we will be talking with a journalist and an athlete about some of the issues around sexual harassment and sexual abuse and athletes in the Me Too movement. That's tomorrow with Rose Aguilar. She returns tomorrow. Today, we're discussing how corporations acquire and use data about us. And we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255 is the number. And Kevin Carty, reporter and researcher at the Open Markets Institute, is our guest. Let's go to the phones. Calls, starting with Roberta in San Francisco. Hi, Roberta. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for the program. So a couple of comments. Data and marketing has been collecting data on people for a long time, since marketing was created for businesses, to get an understanding of, you know, who their market is, how to better reach out to them, right?
Right.
So now that we're in the tech revolution, you know, this is another way of a couple of things of I think corporations underemploying people, because you don't need as many marketing people if you have, you know, this data collection going on automatically. Secondarily to that, a comment about, you know, trying to draw a parallel. And I'll just I'm sorry to be outraged about it, but drawing a parallel between a legitimate American party, the Democrats, collecting data to fine-tune and understand what the American people are concerned about the most is really different than the Russians coming in, gathering data, and hacking our entire democratic system. I mean, really. Let's have an honest discussion about that. I understand marketing happens, and I don't think that it should. I think we need to get that under control, like what we're talking about. There are some abuses, and we need to figure out how to stop that. But
okay. Thanks,
some
Roberta.
Information is important to move forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Roberta. So, Kevin Carty, making a distinction between the better angels of our nature in terms of just trying to find out what people's needs and wants and desires are, and those who would profit from filling those needs.
Yeah, well, it is true that Facebook and these companies do collect a lot of data, and I understand Roberta's concern about this. You know, that these companies are collecting a lot of data that can be very useful and that can be very helpful for all of us, for all sorts of purposes. You know, there have been a lot of great research papers created using Facebook data. But the important thing, I think, is that we should decide as a country who is the person to be in charge of that data. Right now, we've got a couple of giant private companies that have really monopolistic market positions. They're the ones who are deciding what to do with our data. And we think at the Open Markets Institute that properly, you know, designed, it should be the people, the U.S. government deciding who should get access to this data, how it should be collected, how it should be used. You know, clearly we're going to keep having data collected about us. Roberta's right that this has been going on for a long time, and she's also right that it can be used to gather good and useful information about voters. But ultimately, that data collection needs to be accountable to democratic politics, to elected officials and citizens making their voices heard, not to private monopolists.
And you also, before the break, talked about the disconnect that is created from between the people who are creating a service and those who are making money off of making connection. For example, Apple and Spotify are basically controlling the music streaming market, something like 40%, maybe even more than that, 45% of all on-demand music listening is going through YouTube. But unfortunately, it means that the artists have no bargaining power whatsoever. And look at the book publishing business. Amazon sells 55% of all books. It's just extraordinary how it's creating a disconnect, yes?
Yeah, and because these companies, whether you're talking about Spotify or Amazon, disconnects the person buying the music, in the case of Spotify and Apple, from the actual musician producing the music, they've created this kind of middleman power over the entire market. And you're right, it really makes it more difficult for musicians to come together and bargain for better deals. You know, say 30, 40 years ago, everyone from Target to Walmart to your local record store to the small record store down the block to the big, you know, I'm forgetting the name of these old record stores, Sam Goody, et cetera, because they don't exist anymore.
Oh, good old Sam Goody, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. Well, it mm-hmm. used to be that if you were a musician, you could sell your music to Sam Goody and Target and Walmart and mm-hmm. the local record store down the way and all of these different companies. And so you could have some bargaining power over what deal you got. But now, because it's only one or two companies, in the case of music, that's buying up all of these musicians' products, that it's Apple and Spotify controlling the market, that means they've got the power to determine the price. And they've been driving the price lower and lower and lower. And there's lots of evidence about this, that musicians are really, truly making less money than they used to, that the cash value of the music industry, the money value of everything sold and streamed, is lower than it was by a huge margin 20 years ago. And we can really lay the blame for that at the feet of Apple, you know, for creating this model, you know, about 15 years ago or so, and at the feet of Spotify for kind of really carrying it forward.
Authors, too, they are complaining that between 2009 and 2015, they averaged about $25,000 a year. In that span of time, an author now gets about $17,000 a year, and it's really having an impact across the board. I think people are also interested in talking about what they can do to protect their privacy. That's GS's question in South Lake Tahoe. So let's go to GS on the phone. Hi, GS.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
Can you hear me? Okay.
We can hear you great. As long as you turn down your radio. Turn down your radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just listening to you through here. Anyway, so a couple of things. First of all, what we're dealing with is very, very serious companies who are serious about marketing, and they're also staffed by extremely intelligent people who write software to, you know, to do what they need to do, or I should say, want to do. And I'll just give a couple of examples of how you might be able at least to become aware of what's going on. First of all, I'll recommend a nonprofit organization called Mozilla, MOZILLA.org. As a nonprofit, they basically do a lot of things that are useful for people, but among other things, they came out with a browser called Firefox. And I'm sure people can get it easily on just about any platform. There is a script. If you're running a Windows machine, for sure, I used to have one. It's a program, it's an add-on, I guess you should call it, an extension, called NoScript, N-O-S-C-R-I-P-T. If you run NoScript under the Firefox browser and point it at a website, you will be able to see all the scripts which are being run using your data and sending it far and wide. I pointed it at FaceScript once, and it was jaw-dropping. They had over 30 scripts, each of them tuned to send data to very specific kinds of their customers, as you say, the ones who they make money from. So there you go. So okay. Anyway, that's NoScript under Firefox on a PC. On a Mac, there's also an app called ProScript, P-R-O, and again, the word script. And each of these are kind of technical, but if you just run the Firefox browser and point it at Facebook, you too can see what's going on under the hood. The rest is just, can you understand it? It's fun to look at it, but that's how they're doing it.
Thank you, GS. Appreciate that. All right, let's go to another caller, Arturo in San Francisco. Thanks for holding.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question which is pretty much related to the previous speaker, the knowledgeable speaker. To what degree is a person, say, some almost non-existent iconoclast who may not even be on platforms and never been on so-called platforms, to what degree is that person subject to having information gathered and disseminated just as a result of just a normal intercourse of a landline telephone, interchanges with city agencies and, say, nonprofits that are probably pretty slack-jawed about security. Mm. To what degree is that a kind of secondary or tertiary information gathering and dissemination taking place?
Arturo, thanks for your question. Kevin Carty, Open Markets Institute. Is it possible to create a hypothetical person, an avatar, if you will, to walk through life and protect your real identity and your own personal data?
Yeah, well, if you want to give, you know, the information about this hypothetical person instead of your own, that will, you know, make it more difficult for tech companies to follow you. You know, if you use a different name, if you don't put your exact birthday in when a website asks for it, that can make it more difficult for these companies to track you. But I think kind of this gets to a broader point is that the caller, you know, noted that, you know, what about somebody who's not on any of these big platforms? And it's true that if you're not on, you know, quote unquote, the big platforms like, say, Google or Facebook or Amazon, or, you know, similar services like, say, Yahoo, which, you know, a lot of people use for email. If you're not on those platforms, you won't have necessarily as much data collected on you, but it is also very difficult to know what data is actually collected on you. I gave the example earlier of how Facebook tracks people's internet browsing, but there's also another example I think that would be useful for this hypothetical person. So let's say our hypothetical person, let's call them, you know, Bobby, you know, this hypothetical person who doesn't, you know, use these internet services. If his contact information is in one of his friend's phones in his friend's contact list, and that friend downloads Facebook, Facebook asks, hey, can we see your contact list so we can make more connections with your friends? This, you know, the friend says, yeah, sure, why not, and shares their contact list. Well, then suddenly Facebook has all of the information contained in that person's contact list. Whether or not you're somebody on that contact list and, you know, whether or not you actually consented to that information going to Facebook. So that means that if my mom doesn't want Facebook to know information about her, but I give Facebook access to my list of contacts, they still know all of my mom's information because it's in my contact list. So that kind of illustrates that you can set up barriers and you can stop this, but privacy is kind of a collective thing. It's not just determined by people's individual decisions. And so we have to get at it in a kind of more thoroughgoing, serious way rather than just relying on individual people to make individual choices.
Well, it appears Europe is at least trying something, the General Data Protection Regulation, which also didn't get a lot of discussion, I didn't think, during the Zuckerberg congressional hearings. But they just started by, if nothing else, just things like reversing Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp and Instagram. You know, literally just breaking that off and then prohibiting any future acquisitions. So mergers are one way for companies to become monopolies and corner the market on this information and for people to have fewer options for opting out. So what do you think about Europe's approach so far?
Well, the GDPR, we think, is, and just for folks who, you know, it is kind of hard to keep track of all these new tech, you know, rules and policies that everyone's talking about. Basically, the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, is this new law in Europe that they passed a little while back and which will take effect on May 25th, so just next month, that seeks to give users a lot more control over their own data within these services. So companies need to ask for more consent. They have to be more specific about exactly how that data is being used. And generally, it tries to give users an individual right to their own data and how it's being used. We think that, you know, we at the Open Markets Institute think that's a really good start to kind of remind everybody that at the end of the day, it is the users, not the companies, which ought to control this data and ought to have power over it. But like I said earlier, privacy is a shared collective value. It's not something that can be just delivered or ensured by going after individual people and having individual people make their own right decisions. We have to create it at a country, a global level. And so while we think GDPR is a really great start, and it's going to be really useful to see how this law gets implemented and how it changes the business models of these countries, these companies, we're concerned that it's not really going to get at all of these issues. Facebook is still going to have a monopoly in social media. Google is still going to have a monopoly in search. Amazon is still going to be the most powerful e-commerce company in the world and able to use that power in anti-competitive ways. So the GDPR is a great start, but ultimately we're going to need more than that.
Okay, let's go to Lisa next in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I wanted to mention that a lot of what's happening coming out right now has already been warned to us by Edward Snowden. It's been pretty clear that there's also been a corporate and government collusion in controlling people's voting habits for quite some time. If anybody would be interested in going to the Grand Lake Theater tomorrow and watching Greg Palast's incredible documentary called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, you would be seeing that for the past more than 20 years, we've had the Koch brothers and Mercers manipulating our data and in fact, participating with officials, the government has been using that data to sort of purge voter rolls and gerrymander and a lot of other things that people are unaware of. Everybody's up in arms about Russia doing it, but nobody has said anything about our very own billionaires here doing it to us.
Thank you, Lisa. Speaking of the government, you know, I was kind of surprised in prepping for the show, Kevin, that the Intuit, the maker of TurboTax, these products are often billed as free. What's the business model that those tax prep software companies are using? What kind of information do they have about us? And the proposal that says we can simplify our taxes because the government already has all the information they would want to have on us anyway, so might as well just simplify it by letting the process just include what the government already knows about us. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I absolutely support a program to try and make tax filing simpler. I don't think I'm the only one who gets annoyed at the amount of time I have to spend filing my own taxes. But part of the reason we don't have a more simple tax filing system is because companies like Intuit and H&R Block, they're really the two biggest that are active on this issue, have lobbied the federal government against simpler tax filing legislation. There are laws that have been proposed. I believe Senator Elizabeth Warren has proposed one that would have the government send to you an already filled out tax reform, tax return, not reform. you know, the government already has a bunch of your information about, you know, where you've worked and how much money you made and how much taxes they've already withheld. So why shouldn't they just fill out that tax form for you, send it to you, you check it over, see if there are any mistakes, add anything they missed, and then you're done. And it's simpler than having to do everything from scratch. Well, Intuit and H&R Block have lobbied against that bill and others like it. So their business model is in part dependent upon our confusion at our own tax system, that it's difficult and challenging to use, and they profit from that continuing to be difficult and challenging to use.
We're talking to Kevin Carty of the Open Markets Institute, and the lines are full. Not surprisingly, this is something people feel very strongly about. So let's go to Laron in San Francisco. Thanks for calling, Laron.
Well, thanks for having me.
What's your question?
I'm sorry.
Sure. What's your question?
Yeah. So I know you keep mentioning middlemen and how they are just all throughout pretty much everything, technology and all the big guys. They're all just mostly middlemen. And I'm just curious about like how those people can pay us and how like Facebook can possibly, they're taking all of our data. How can they pay us? And then I learned about blockchain. You know, it's the buzzword blockchain. You keep hearing that. And the more I learn about that, the more I'm noticing that it's a new emerging market that's technology based that's going to allow us to make profit from our data and the attention economy itself. And do you have any comments on that and maybe educating people on blockchain?
Kevin Carty, how do we monetize the fact that we are the product?
I think it's a good idea that we should certainly explore. These companies are benefiting from our data, and so therefore maybe we should be the ones benefiting from it or making money from it or for, you know, whatever. Now, Facebook argues that we are already benefiting from it because Facebook gives us a free service in exchange for doing our data, but I think a lot of us think that's not exactly the best trade. To the caller's point, I think it is a good idea that we should all, you know, be looking at and considering. But I also think that it might not having these companies pay us for our data keeps those companies with their still, you know, monopolistic position. Facebook is still going to be the biggest social media company in the world, and that's going to create problems. You know, data collection is a big source of Facebook's power, but it is not the only source of Facebook's power. Facebook also is so big just because so many people use it, and so other businesses, like, you know, you mentioned earlier, newspapers and news organizations have to rely on Facebook to distribute their products, in the case of newspapers, to distribute the news. So Facebook's going to continue to have that power, even if Facebook also, you know, is made to pay us for our data. And so while that is, you know, I think a good idea that I have been interested in and, you know, looking at some more, I think it ultimately won't be enough. And we have to really change the market structure itself to get at these issues.
We're talking about how corporations acquire and use data about us. Love to hear from you. Which companies do you think have your data? What do you want to know about how they're using it? And what can you do to protect your privacy, maybe in the age of online services? 866-798-8255 is the number. Let's go to Roger in Silicon Valley. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Renee. Thanks for having me, and thank you for your show. I appreciate what you're doing here. You know, I had a comment that I wanted to make here, and that's, you know, we need to focus on the source of life for these companies, right? So we want these companies to be responsible with our data. We want them to make us whole, pay us, all of those things. But what about the people funding these organizations, right? Those are the ones that make these giants a monopoly and prevent, you know, competition from coming out and offering that type of equity that your previous caller, you know, talked about. So my suggestion is, you know, we are the product, right? So at the same time, we're also, you know, the egg for the chicken scenario. Mm-hmm. So why don't we hold the, you know, these big tech companies, to a higher standard, number one, and number two, you know, make the demand of the people funding these organizations so that, you know what, the bottles that are going out and using our data are not these, you know, irresponsible models that, you know, really belong in the in history. Remember the mailbox when you go and you get the mail out of the mailbox and it's a bunch of junk mail? Well,
yeah.
It just basically adopted the tech, you know, as the new way to do that. And that's what we're getting. It's just a bunch of junk you know, we're our data is all over the place, and we're not made whole by it. So I think it's time that, you know, we started looking at the entire ecosystem, not freak out over the fallout of this whole Russia thing, right? And think about what's the future. How do we rebuild this? We have to use tech. We're never going to go back to pencil and paper. We got to use our phones. We got to use our devices. We got to look at the entire ecosystem and hold everybody responsible. Anyways, thank you very much, Renee.
Thanks, Roger. Thank you. Looking for remedies here, Kevin, your thoughts on going toward digital IDs, just some ways, as Roger was saying, of trying to recapture our very own identities and our data.
Well, I do think there's a whole bunch of other ways that the internet, you know, could be organized, that the internet economy could be organized. We don't need to have, you know, just a handful of companies being so powerful. I mean, I think there are lots of things we can do. You know, Open Markets Institute has called for breakups, for breaking off these, you know, different parts of companies. For instance, you know, making Google divest of YouTube, making Facebook divest of Instagram and WhatsApp, so that, you know, that would hopefully restore more competition in the space, so that these companies don't own anything. That's a good idea, I think. Another idea would be, you know, just better data privacy laws, period, to limit the extent to which the companies can collect data in the first place. And then last but not least, I think rules for neutrality, so that if Facebook is going to be this, you know, social media company, then Facebook should have to treat other businesses that rely on it fairly. So if you're, you know, we've given this example a couple times, if you're a newspaper that is trying to distribute news through Facebook because so many people are on Facebook, well, then Facebook should have to treat that news fairly. It shouldn't be able to favor one news story over another, as it does now via its algorithm. So rules for neutrality can really help a lot of the rest of the internet ecosystem. I think those are some ideas. But like I said, I think the internet is a huge and new and exciting place that can really give us a lot of new freedoms and new possibilities. And so we should be optimistic in thinking about ways that we can change it. And there are lots and lots of new policies that I think would go a long way towards addressing that. But fundamentally, we have to address the corporate power of the biggest companies, which dominate the sector.
Well, Tara in Berkeley, we didn't have a chance to get to your call, but I think your question is a good way to wrap it up with a couple of minutes left, Kevin. And Tara in Berkeley says, seems like that ship has sailed. Is there really any remedy to this? So with about a minute and a half left, your final thoughts?
Well, I think, like I said, we should wind off the acquisitions that Google, Facebook, and Amazon have made, make Amazon sell off Whole Foods, make Google sell off WhatsApp, so that if these companies are going to be big, they shouldn't also have all their competitors. We should block them from future acquisitions. We should stop them from discriminating against businesses that use their platforms. And we should, you know, reinvigorate antitrust policy to ensure that we've got more competition all across the internet ecosystem. And I think that can make the world and the internet a much better place.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kevin Carty, reporter and researcher at the Open Markets Institute. This is one of those things that people have questions about, and they're not even sure how to ask the questions because the technology itself can be so confusing. So thanks for shedding some light on the subject, and I'm sure we'll be revisiting it.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, indeedy. That's Kevin Carty, reporter and researcher at the Open Markets Institute. That's a research and advocacy group that's keeping tabs on the corporate monopolies, on those corporations that are collecting your data. Thank you for joining us. To listen to past shows or join our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. To listen to past shows, you can also go to iTunes. Laura Wenas is the producer of today's show. Joshua Wilner is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. And we thank you for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call.